At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Lowe's knows tough jobs call for tougher tools. The new DeWalt Elite Series power tool accessories are built to last for the pro who doesn't stop. With precision fitment, durability, and impact resistance, finishing jobs faster has never been easier. Shop the new DeWalt Elite Series at an everyday low price exclusively at Lowe's. We help, you save.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Mornings can start feeling the same. Wake up, brush teeth, go to work. But with breakfast from Wendy's, it's like, wake up, brush teeth, baconate with a breakfast baconator, roll with the sausage breakfast burrito, buddy it up with a honey buddy, or get seasoned with seasoned potatoes, and then go to work. Sorry. When you're ready for a fresh wake-up call, gotta be Wendy's.
At participating U.S. Wendy's during breakfast hours.
This is The Big Breakdown, a long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
See something, say something. What were the early warning signs? How could Brian Koberger have been prevented? That's a great question, because there were a lot of warning signs. There were a lot of social cues that this was not a man in his right mind. But what do you do when there's all the signs? You can't just go arrest somebody for being icky and weird. So what do you do? What do we do as a society for folks like this? Because we're seeing so many of them. We're seeing so many of them in the news where, well, everybody warned everybody. Parents were aware, families aware, friends aware, society's aware that this could potentially be a monster. Unless you're going to have somebody watching that person 24/7 or lock them away against their will, I don't know what you do. We're going to go through all of the stuff, all the warning signs of Brian Koberger that have just been revealed. I welcome your comments in the comment section on YouTube. If you're not there already, just search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi and press subscribe as well. Because there's a lot. There's a lot of weirdness to Koberger, a lot of uncomfortable, a lot of this guy is going to do some horrible stuff. But we don't arrest people. We don't stop people for crimes that we think they might commit. And that's a good thing. We don't want to live in a society like that. But what do we do with folks like this? He walked into Pullman in late August, like any other first-year doctoral student. New backpack, new building, that mix of ambition and nerves you can smell on a grad student in the first week. If you don't know any better, you'd think Brian Koberger was just another criminology kid trying to make his way. But inside that department, the temperature shifted almost immediately. People started whispering, first cautiously, then constantly, because it wasn't one weird comment or an awkward interaction. It was a pattern that gathered speed. The way he focused on women, the way he talked to them, the way he seemed to enjoy making them small. Before Labor Day, he was even out of the rear view. The first formal complaint was on record. By Thanksgiving, there were a dozen more. At least 9 complaints appear in the department's logs. Broader interviews collected by police tally 13, and we're going to go through all of them. Either way, the picture is the same. People inside Washington State University's criminology program felt uneasy and, in some cases, unsafe around Brian Koberger. What bothered them wasn't a single dramatic blow-up. It was the drumbeat. A professor assigned to help shepherd the new cohort said her calendar started filling with conversations she didn't expect to have. Not about coursework, but about Brian. His comments, his conduct, the way he'd hover and stare at basic boundaries as if they were optional. She told investigators he would sometimes step into the shared office where several female grad students worked and physically plant himself in the doorway. She once heard a student say, "I really need to get out of here," and had to intervene so the woman could leave. He had no clue, standing there in that doorway. Or did he have a clue? And he was wielding that dark power he had of intimidation and fear. The same professor said the department was spending an uncomfortable amount of time discussing him in disciplinary meetings. And when those meetings ended, more notes rolled in. Students called his behavior sexist and creepy. Colleagues saying his condescension towards women wasn't a bad day. It was a baseline. If you want the granular detail, listen to the people who were on the receiving end. A divorced woman in the program told police he dismissed her as broken. A deaf classmate recalled being asked straight-faced if she would be comfortable procreating, given her disability. Others described him standing too close, leaning over women in ways that felt less like proximity and more like pressure. I want to note one thing on the procreation end of things, because this seems to be a bizarre affect of Brian Koberger. He also went on that Tinder date, remember? And said, "You have good birthing hips." This is a man that seems to be very obsessed with natural process in some way, shape, or form. Would you feel good procreating, the terminology, because of your disability? That's not Hitlerish or anything. Female-led classes turned into a running bit of tracking. Classmates literally kept a board to note how often he showed up late to courses taught by women. A male grad student said he got verbally kidnapped in the parking lot, trapped in a three-hour monologue in which Brian bragged about that he could pick up any woman he wanted. And by September, weeks into the term, his reputation had already calcified as being a douche. As one classmate put it, these aren't internet rumors. They come out of interviews compiled by detectives and reflected in unsealed summaries. The kind of paper trail you wish you didn't have that existed. The ugliest line threads through the youngest person in the building. A 19-year-old undergraduate who worked in the department told police he kept peering at her office, boxing her in when she tried to leave and push past the word no like it wasn't there. When she mentioned she was seeing a woman, it didn't slow him down. She began getting escorted home by a boss. Precautions you take when your gut is telling you this isn't just social awkwardness. A neighbor of hers reported seeing someone right outside her window. Later, the student learned Brian lived nearby. The effect was cumulative, not a single incident to explain away, but a sequence you can feel in your body, cornered at work, watched at home, never sure when. You're around a blind hallway and will find him standing there, waiting for you. Inside faculty offices, the talk got sharper. One professor experienced enough to recognize predators long before they're charged with anything and warned colleagues that if this man ever stood at the front of a classroom, the story would end with an SA and stalking. She urged the department to cut his funding to push him out. In the same packet of interviews, she told investigators about a reported break-in at a female grad student's apartment that fall, with perfume and underwear taken, an incident that, to her, fit too neatly with what she feared he was. In the graduate halls, people traded a phrase that seemed to relish sexual burglary, his self-described research interest. Was it a detached academic label, sexual burglary? Or a window into fantasy? Piers speculated openly that he might be an incel. This wasn't the campus rumor mill. It was the climate of a department writing down what it had seen and was trying to keep the floor from tilting under their feet. When the complaints stacked high enough, the school pulled a lever you rarely see. Mandatory discrimination training for the first year doctoral cohort. On November 8, 2022, according to the interviews, 5 days later, the murders in Moscow, you don't have to weave a conspiracy board to see why timelines make people's stomachs drop. The same students who had been told to sit through a training because of his comments now watched news alerts about four young lives slashed from a neighboring campus. Then they watched him walk back into their classroom. That's a moment that tends to freeze people in their retelling. The way he looked when he returned from Thanksgiving break. Injuries. These are not rumors. Specific descriptions. A classmate sitting 3 feet away clocked bruised knuckles, a wash of redness halfway up the back of his left hand, and a distinct cut on his ring finger. Another student used the phrase cat scratch cuts to describe what she saw on his hands. Others saw wounds on his knuckles and thought he looked like a man who'd been hitting something. He gave different explanations to different people: boxing, an indoor accident, a car crash. And he started wearing a puffy jacket in classes like he'd suddenly gotten cold. That detail sticks because it reads like a person trying to hide the map of what happened across his forearms. The signs were there. It is kind of amazing to me that after there were these homicides and Koberger's driving this white car that people are looking for, and all these students saw all of these undisclosed marks, bizarre marks that he has different stories for, that there wasn't a red flag and a target put on him early on. But you're talking about students. You're talking about young people. You're talking about young people who are extremely inexperienced in life and questionable circumstances and scary situations. You had the girls who didn't call 911 for how many hours, and people trying to understand that way of thinking. I think that's how you need to look at this as well. There's a different mindset, it seems, with a lot of young people on what to do with this sort of information. And unfortunately, it leads to social media and it leads to telling friends. It does not always lead to telling the people who can do something. But even if you did do something, even if you said something, see something, say something, like we're always told to do, maybe these young people have had enough of doing that and being ignored that it means absolutely nothing anymore to them because it never meant jack shit to them throughout their entire existence. Just as it doesn't mean anything to most of us anymore who have said something as well, who used to live in a society where when you did say something, things usually occurred. Things were looked into. Now it's just a slogan, a bumper sticker. We see at airports. We throw around school campuses. We tell young women. And when they've said something, nothing ever happens. So what do you expect out of these young students at this moment in time, really? If you're wondering whether any of this lines up with the violence inside that house, the unsealed records say Zanna Kornodal fought hard. Investigators wrote about defensive wounds and cast off blood that signaled an intense struggle in the room where she died. The point isn't to be graphic. It's to understand why a man might show up with shredded skin across his knuckles and a cut on his ring finger days after four young people were murdered. And nobody thought to look there. Even his own posture shifted. Classmates noticed he stopped bringing his phone to class after the killings, looked more disheveled, and seemed determined not to join the conversations every other person on campus was having about the murders. One student eventually called the tip line to report having seen him with bloody knuckles shortly before the attacks. Or shortly after the attacks, I should say. And in a moment that still makes people's voices drop, he supposedly commented that whoever committed the crime Must have been pretty good. And maybe a one and done event, like a criminology post-mortem, stripped of empathy. Must have been pretty good. Maybe a one and done. As the guy with stripped knuckles, days after this, driving the car they're searching for, says aloud. The number of complaints can feel abstract. So it's worth slowing down and showing you how they sound in the raw. Reports of outspoken discriminatory comments, homophobic, xenophobic, misogynistic, get written off sometimes as personality flaws. But when those words are paired with proximity, his habit of standing too close, leaning over the shoulders of women, blocking their path to the door, the behavior stops living in the hypothetical. A woman staring at her keyboard while feeling someone's breath at their shoulder is not debating theory. She's trying to keep her pulse at a manageable clip. Another student describing a three-hour hallway monologue isn't looking to make news. He's telling you what it feels like to be trapped in a conversation with a man who needs you to know he can dominate a room the way he believes he can dominate a woman. When these stories are told in isolation, you can argue about interpretations. When they arrive 13 times in 3 months, the argument withers. There's also the part nobody wants to admit out loud. Plenty of people with tenure and titles saw it. The professor's warning, mark my word, reads today like an alarm bell everybody heard and nobody could unmuffle. She said plainly, in a few years, with a doctorate and a classroom, he'd be the kind of teacher who gets exposed for essay and stalking. And it didn't take a few years. You can chalk that up to hindsight if it makes you feel better. But her words were on paper weeks before the murders. She even urged a concrete step, cutting his funding, getting him out, close the door, which they eventually did. Bureaucracies don't move that fast, though. Committees meet, calendars filled, guidelines are reviewed, and while the machine does what it does, people keep taking the long way around the hallway where he might be standing. The detail that rattles is how ordinary the days looked from the outside. He still showed up to class. He still sent emails, oblivious to everyone around him. A professor recalled him arriving incredibly late on November 15th, then firing off a message 2 days later about not being there, and on the 18th, switching his car registration from Pennsylvania to Washington. Kinds of everyday administrative moves that mean nothing on their own, but look different when context arrives. There's even a note in the records about a selfie taken hours after the murders. You know that one. Arms covered. Questionable fingers. One more breadcrumb people wish didn't exist. Stack that next to a puffy jacket and the raw knuckles, and it stops feeling like coincidence. It reads like a man trying to cover a map. Students remember he changed after the killings in ways that feel obvious once you've seen someone cross a line. The phone line or the phone left behind, the careful avoidance of case chatter, the disheveled look that says sleep is an issue, the offhand clinical compliments about a killer's skill as if this were a paper to grade, not a house ripped open with a knife and fellow students massacred. At least one student tied what she seemed to a call to police, the bloody knuckles, the vibe of someone who'd been fighting with drywall or something harder. If you're looking for the moment where a campus rumor becomes a documented concern, it's right there in the call logs and in the interview notes. It all points back to the core. Inside that department, people experience a sustained pattern of intimidation and denigration, aimed mostly at women, and wrote it down. A university answered with training. A professor tried to pull the ripcord, warning plainly where this kind of personality often lands. And then four students were murdered across the state line, and the man everyone had been filing away as a problem reappeared with marks on his hands and a new way of moving through the building. You can call it hindsight bias if you need a blunt edge, but the paper trail existed before the bodies were found. That's the part that keeps you awake. The warnings were not invented after the fact. They were already stamped with dates. But look what they were trying to do within the school. Because that's all they could do. Move him along somewhere else. Pass the trash. We saw it with the Andrew McGann case in Arkansas. The elementary teacher passed from school to school. No disciplinary actions noted to the next school. Just filed away privately, quietly. You take our trash. You deal with him. He's your problem now. Had he not killed, that's exactly what would have happened. Someone else's problem. Because what do you do when these signs exist and there's nothing you can do to stop them? There's a point in every retelling where people ask if anyone could have stopped it. It's a fair question, and it sits heavy because there isn't a clean answer. Universities aren't criminal courts. They run on committees and codes of conduct, not probable cause. You can sanction speech, coach a student, require a training session. You can't predict a massacre. But what the record shows is a department trying to hold a line with the tools it had while a specific man tested how far he could lean over that line without being thrown out. And when you strip away the legal language, the psychology buzzwords, the academic brand names, the story reads like a simple human calculus. He told you who he was. The people around him believed him. The system didn't move fast enough. Today, obviously, the case is adjudicated. He's serving life without parole, the death penalty off the table after the guilty plea. The families will never get what they lost. The classmates will never unlearn how quickly a seminar room can tilt from uncomfortable to dangerous. The records will sit on a state website where people cycle through them for a class paper or documentary, pulling the same quotes that have been haunting the folks who actually lived them. If there's any use left in this story, it's the way it clarifies the stakes. When a swarm of small harms collects around a single person, demanding attention with demeaning comments, doorways blocked, a teenager escorted home, a professor saying, "Mark my word," it isn't overreacting to take it seriously. Sometimes a pattern is more than attitude. Sometimes it's a roadmap with the ending already penciled in. The Brian Koberger complaint letters. That's what we are digging into today. Welcome, everyone. We knew it would happen. I didn't think we'd expect it, I don't know, quite this fast or quite this detached from reality of where he is and what he's experiencing. And I guess the level of discomfort, the bar is pretty low for Koberger. He goes from complaining about people saying that, well, the only we're going to be eating is Koberger's, to complaining that he's not getting a full balanced meal in prison because when items are not available, he's not getting a replacement item, and he'd like that to be addressed. We're going to go through all of these letters, but let's begin with the first one. It goes back to July 30th, 2025, just one day after being moved to Idaho's maximum security institution. Brian Koberger put pen to paper and filed his very first prison grievance. He'd barely spent 24 hours on J Block before deciding he'd have enough. Oh, poor Brian. It's not working out so well so far now, is it? So let's take a look at the initial letter. And this is, if you're watching us on YouTube, this is the letter. There's two more we're going to go through after this. This is the letter with the response. So this is the resident concern form. And I'm going to read this out to you in full. Number one, I want to say, just look at this guy's handwriting. If you're a handwriting analyzer or have any experience in it or just know a little bit, this guy is a study in that handwriting. This looks, I mean, I do not have good handwriting, I'll tell you that much. This is like weird second grade level stuff. It's bizarre. And the signature, that's like third grade where they say, okay, let's learn how to do a signature. Like he stuck with it. It was like first draft. Okay, I guess I got a signature now. It's so weird. It's like, it's questionable. You can tell there's like hesitation in the signature. Like, is this how I write my signature? Anyway, here's the letter. As I continue the SPI phase. I wish to discuss if I may be transferred to another ad SAG setting, such as B block, not engaging in any of the recent flooding striking, as well as being subject to minute-by-minute verbal threats, harassment, and on that and other bases. Unit 2 of J Block is an environment that I wish to transfer from. I request transfer to B Block immediately. I wish to speak with you soon. That's what it's all about. So let me give you a little context here. The flooding, the other blocks, because this is a solitary confinement unit, the other blocks that are around him, they're flooding them. The inmates are flooding them so that the water drips through and then goes into his cell. He's none too happy about that. So there was a response. I should note that before we go into the next letter. Let's take a look at that real quick. The response to this. I'm gonna bring it up here so you guys can see it a little bit better. Mr. Koberger, on any tier at MSI, there are sometimes disruptions to operations, such as residents flooding on J2, is a relatively rare occurrence, and J2 is generally a fairly calm and quieter tier. I do not think that B Block would be any better for you. Give it some time. And then the captain signed it on August 1st. So let's just talk about that whole thing for a moment. And I'd love to get your thoughts in the comment section. And like I said, we got two more letters to go through. So stick around. It gets better. So this letter here, no emotion, no flourish, just the dry bureaucratic note written by a man who studied the psychology of crime for years and once imagined himself as an academic insider on the subject. Now he's inside the system for real. And the words he chose are almost comical in their formality. As I continue the SPI phase, another ad seg setting, on that and other bases, he wrote, as if prison officials were going to read this like a research paper and nod in agreement. Oh, yes. Look how he said that. I agree that, they're not complying. Well, obviously, they didn't read it that way. Officials reviewed his complaint and denied the request. They told him the flooding in J Block was relatively rare and T2 was generally calmer than other housing areas, and that moving him to B Block wouldn't make his situation any better. Their advice was simple. Give it some time. He isn't going anywhere. I'd say, hey, you know, let's let him start doing what he wants. Like, if he thinks it's going to be better over in B Block and it's going to be worse, move him to B Block. If he thinks general population at some point after B Block sucks is a better idea, move him to general population. Just let him keep thinking he's in control until he's killed. I think that would be the quickest way. He's so dumb when it comes to his own self-preservation that he will walk himself off the cliff. That's the funny thing with people like this. You think you have to, like, you gotta take him out, you gotta do this. Like, they will take themselves out. You gotta stop them from hurting other people. Yes, definitely. But if you let them, if you know their jig, and this is usually for more, you know, non-murderous types, the non-murdering narcissist, if you just let them flail in the wind, if you let them sit on the shore like a fish out of water, and they need you as water to thrive on their madness. If you're not giving them water, they can only flail around for so long. 5 days later, Koberger tried again. This time he claimed what he called sexual harassment. He handed another note to the guard saying inmates were threatening him with crude remarks. One allegedly shouted, "I'll BF you." I'm thinking this might be the more conservative shouts that he received. Another, he wrote, said, "The only ass we'll be eating is Koberger's." in the sterile language of the prison system. That's what's logged as evidence of mistreatment. Here's the full letter. This was obtained by our friends over at News Nation. I will I'll read it for you here. I'm going to put my glasses on so I can see it better over on that screen. On August 3rd, 2025, this is the brief summary that was given. So basically, Koberger reiterated this to a guard, and then this is how the complaint was lodged. On August 3rd, 2025, resident Koberger, IDOC 163214, submitted a concern from stating he, quote, has been subject to threats and harassment, recently escalating to overt sexual violent threats and statements. Lieutenant Mandheld received the concern form on August 4th of 2025 and conducted an interview with Koberger in J Block. Koberger stated a resident that goes by Peru told him, quote, I'll BF you. If you're questioning what any of that means, B meaning the piece behind you where poo comes out, and F meaning the F word. Okay. So now that we put that all together, Koberger also stated an unknown resident from tier one of the J Block said the only ass will be eating is Koberger's. This is what stood out to Koberger. This is the, now keep in mind, he's being taunted 24 hours a day in this thing. Those are the ones that stuck with him most. I can imagine there was hundreds of others, but these are the two that really Koberger wanted to make sure made it made it to the document complaint. He's very concerned about the ass eating. He's very concerned, like, this shit. Like, do I need to get some ranch or something to make this work, or what the... Koberger stated that Officer Signora was present for the comment made by Peru. Due to Officer Signora being on B nights, an interview could not be conducted to attempt to corroborate the allegation. On August 7th, it continues, Officer Signora submitted an information report outlining his involvement of the alleged incident. Officer Signora recalls vulgar language being used and directed towards Koberger, but could not identify who said what. The allegation is substantiated, but due to no aggressor being able to be positively identified and Koberger saying he feels safe to remain in Tier 2 in J Block, no further actions were taken. The delay in the 105 submission date and the report date is due to collecting all the information to ensure a proper action could be taken as needed. End of report. I don't know what Koberger thought prison was going to be like, but his bar is pretty low, as is continued here. So there's another letter, but let's just talk about this one for a brief moment, shall we? And let me know your thoughts in the comments section on YouTube. The guard who received the note later admitted that they recalled vulgar language, of course, being thrown around. And once again, the prison's conclusion was the same. Koberger feels safe. Transfer denied. It's where the reality of prison life collides with entitlement of someone like Koberger. The same man who spent months circling victims' houses, plotting, prepping, allegedly leaving his DNA behind on a knife sheath. Not allegedly, he did. Stabbing four young people in their beds. That man now insists that living conditions are unacceptable. He's annoyed by the threats. He's bothered by the noise. He wants to be somewhere quieter. And that's the cruel symmetry here. Koberger spent years studying how killers think and how crime unfolds, but he seemed to have no understanding of what life after conviction really looks like. J-Block is not an academic exercise. It's a maximum security tier in Idaho's harshest prison. It houses men on death row and the state's most violent offenders and lifers who have long since stopped caring about the feelings of a new arrival, which Koberger is. In restrictive housing, which is where Koberger is kept, every detail of life is controlled. He's in a single prison cell. He's restricted whenever he's moved. He gets 1 hour of outdoor recreation per day. And if you ask me, he's pretty lucky right now. Because it's harvesting season on Brian Koberger's you-know-what. And the prisoners are just waiting to get out to the field and make their harvest on Brian Koberger's. Yeah. If you're watching me, I'm holding up a harvest mug because I got some of my fall stuff out. And I was drinking this earlier when I was putting the story together going, how can I tie this in to this story today? He's allowed to shower every other day. That's it. Compared to the county jail where he was previously spending long stretches in solitary, but enjoy the luxury of long showers and light supervision. IMSI is an entirely different world. It's designed to break down resistance, and it's doing its job. What's striking is the way inmates have adapted their own methods of torment. And I gotta say, the ingenuity, guys, very good. If we could harness the ingenuity of our prison system, of the people who are in there, the people who could use their minds, their ingenuity for something good while serving the time for something bad that they did, it could be a great resource. It can also be a great punishment for Brian Koberger that is going to be far worse than the death penalty. Reports say they've been taunting him through the ventilation system. You can picture it, disembodied voices drafting and drifting through metal ducts into his cell at all hours, mocking him, threatening him, erasing the little scraps of peace solitary is supposed to provide. Guards confirm that, yes, vulgar language is being directed at him, but as long as it doesn't turn into physical assault, which it physically can't at this moment in time, it isn't enough to warrant a move. The prison's job isn't to make Brian Koberger comfortable. It's to keep him alive, contained, and serving his sentence. That's a kind of bitter irony to all of this. The families of Kaylee Gonzalez, Madison Mogan, Zanna Kernodle, and Ethan Chapin, the four University of Idaho students Koberger murdered in November 22, don't get the luxury of filing a complaint when their grief becomes unbearable. They don't get to ask the system to relocate their pain to a quieter block. Their loss is permanent. Their boundaries have already been shattered. They're dead because of Koberger. The man who's complaining that people are being loud and rude and flooding his cell and threatening to eat his ass. I hope Steve Gonzalez is getting a good laugh out of that one. I really, really do. But wait, there's more. There's more. This is another prime example of just how disconnected Brian Koberger is from the reality of what is going on around him. He's complaining about lunch. He's complaining about dinner. He's complaining about things that, sorry, that's how prison works. Here's his other complaint letter for us to go through. Again, look at the handwriting. It's and it's the same signature too. It's the same weird, I did this in second grade signature and I stuck with it. This one, this complaint letter reads, I have on several occasions not received all items on food on my tray. All items of food on my tray. I address this during service and have yet to receive any replacements. In fact, the kitchen is not even called. The policy book confirms items missing, which are pointed out at the time of service, will be replaced. I wish to
I'm trying to read this because his handwriting is horrible. I wish toy without exception. Or I wish to, I think, receive or something. Without exception, receive these replacements. Okay, the Y it's a comma. It looks like a Y. I wish to, without exception, receive these replacements. Addressing the, okay, then I have tried to solve the problem informally by, and this is where they fill it out, addressing the issue with staff at the time of meal service. And then this is part of the form. I suggest the following solution to the problem. And this is him. I wish for the items to be called for and items replaced when this occurs. The nutritional standard is not being upheld unless I receive my full tray. And then you got Brian's little, his, you know, weird cryptic signature there. Oh, Brian, keep complaining. You keep giving us lovely content. And this lovely content is continuing to be, your complaints are not quietly going, obviously, to management there at the prison system. They're coming out to everyone, and then they're going back to the prisoners. You know, the ones you're naming by name. Oh, this is going to work out great. This is going to work out great. Yeah, they're hungry, Ryan, and it's harvest season. It is kind of shocking that this monster thinks that he's entitled to some sort of treatment. You can't wrap your mind around it. I think at the end of the day, that's the problem. You can't wrap your mind about what he did, and you can't wrap your mind about what he's thinking with sending these things, because his brain does not work like a normal person.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
It's one thing for a murder suspect to have a close relationship with their parents. It's another to place 3 hours of phone calls to your mother within moments of butchering 4 people. But that's exactly what we've just learned about Brian Koberger. Newly unsealed records don't just confirm the calls we've already heard rumors about. They put timestamps, durations, and frequency to them. A 36-minute call not long after returning home to Pullman. A 54-minute call later that morning while he was driving back towards the crime scene. More calls throughout the day, all adding up to more than 3 hours of contact with one person. Mommy. We're not here to demonize a parent for answering the phone. Not at all. But what does this pattern tell us about Brian Koberger? Is it just habit, the way some people text their spouse or parent every day? Or is it something more calculated or more desperate? Was he seeking comfort, trying to normalize his day after doing something horrifying? Or was this part of a subconscious need to be validated, to hear the one voice that would never challenge him? And then there's the way he referred to them. Mother. Father. Not mom or dad in his phone contacts, in his messages and conversations. On one occasion, he texted his mother, "Father, why is mother not answering the phone?" It's such a clinical, formal way to speak about the two people closest to you. It borders on theatrical. Some might say Norman Bates-esque. Is this an intentional affectation? A reflection or emotional distance, or a symptom of a mind that lives in labels rather than relationships? Former FBI special agent and chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program, Robin Drake, joining us. He spent years dissecting the behaviors of manipulators, spies, and predators. Today, we're breaking down what those calls to mother in timing, tone, and frequency could reveal about Brian Koberger's psychology in the hours after the murders. Was his mother simply an emotional anchor in his storm? Was she unknowingly validating the very rage and self-pity that fueled his crimes? Or was this just another part of a lifelong pattern, one where routine, control, and the reassurance of a familiar voice are the only constraints in an otherwise chaotic mind? So let's get into it. Robin, when you first heard about these calls and saw the sheer amount of time he spent on the phone with his mother that day, what went through your mind?
Oh, that's a great question. My first impression was, of course. And then you start on the overlays, because remember, we keep placing ourselves as best we can in his mind about what his needs are. And again, this is purely conjecture, non-scientific, yeah, in the sense of, you know, non-psychologist side of things. I don't want to overstep for people that probably might know this better. But this to me is the not a missing piece necessarily, but definitely a piece that makes sense because of his need for emotional anchoring is what I'm seeing it as. Mm-hmm. And the thing that really comes into my mind is, all right, so you're talking about what for all that time?
Yeah.
And so here's what I'm thinking. I'm thinking, because people that do horrendous things like he did are people out for retribution. They're full of anger, as he has demonstrated, that we've seen both in the jail and well reported by others. And so you wonder what he's doing for all that time. I think he's doing nothing but bitching, moaning, and complaining about how he's a victim to his mother, and his mother is validating the living hell out of him. Talking about reps, I think she has reps of listening to crazy for a lot of years.
And does she see it as crazy? I mean, this is her son. This is little Brian. You know, obviously they know, or they seem to know, that, you know, Brian's a little different. They've spoken to that. The father has talked about that, has talked about help, you know, trying to get him to be friends with a neighbor when he drops him off in Washington, and like, hey, he's a little shy, a little different, you know, take him, be friends. So they know that about their son, at least. But when you're that close all the time, and I'm assuming that, you know, talking for 3 hours a day, maybe not be that huge of a deviation in the life of Brian Koberger, just right, by conjecture. But if you're around it that much, do you think anything stood out in that call? Do you think there was anything odd to her that morning when she gets a call from Brian? And I know there's a big thing about the timestamps on this, 6:17 a.m. And it was like, well, it's a time difference. Yeah, there is a time difference. So it wasn't necessarily, from what I understand, 6:17 a.m. in Pennsylvania. It was 6:17 a.m. in Washington. So that would make it, what time would that make it in on the East Coast? That would make it later.
Probably 2 hours.
Yeah.
Probably so about 2 hours.
Two or 3 hours. Anyway, it's early in the morning, and it's long calls. What do you think was, what do you think Brian was getting at in these calls, other than complaining? It was, do you think they stood out to mom, I guess, is the question. Is anything out of the ordinary that day when she
looks back? So I guarantee you they stood out to mom. I guarantee they stood out to everyone. I mean, so I communicate with my children, especially my son, a tremendous amount. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't matter whether it's your own child or someone that you're in routine contact with. And I mean routine. I mean, a great example is you and I. You and I are in routine contact. Mm-hmm. It's very easy to see if someone's having a slightly different energy day, mm-hmm, based on our tempo, our energy, our interactions, all these things that we come to baseline as normal from our interactions. It's easy to see if someone's a little off or having a bad day or worse day. And so, especially if you're a parent that has routine, very frequent contact with your children or, mm-hmm, child, especially in this case, you're going to see something that deviates out of norm. I always call it, you know, the force is the force is trembling. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like I can tell within 2 seconds of picking up the phone with my son whether he's having a good day or a bad day or something's off. Mm-hmm. And that's just in microseconds. And this is from a very, very healthy individual, mm-hmm, not someone who just did something as horrendous as Brian. So what I'm guessing is that it spiked out of the norm, probably the timing of the call. Although, you know, hey, things happen during the course of a day. But if he's normally calling at the same time every morning, every other morning, you know, just having an off time for calling is going to be different. I guarantee you his energy on that phone is much different. Mm-hmm. My conjecture is, because they're seeing the event that kind of became the straw that broke the camel's back in his mind, which he was planning this for a long time, but it looked like based on, you know, the horrendous reports we're getting of the children that were mutilated by him, it was a rage. And we know he's got rage issues, and it was a lot. I'm guessing that what had happened with the university threw him into a fit of rage. And so if I was thinking I'm Brian Koberger, trying to hide it, because I don't think he's going to share with his mom, who's his emotional stability. He doesn't want to rock that only anchor emotionally he has yet anyway. He's going to be probably overly focused on complaining about what's happening at school and justifying all of his chaos in his brain by that. Maybe not even consciously realizing his chaos brain might be even caused from the murders he just committed, because he's not a smart guy to me. I keep saying it. He's not smart at all, because he's completely unaware of himself. He's completely unaware of who he is, because he keeps trying to discover who he is. He copies everyone and everything. Yeah. Because he's completely empty. So I think it's probably that.
Because right after this initial call, he goes in the bathroom, does his thumbs up picture, goes out, starts driving around, literally calls mom. After the initial phone call, calls her back as he's driving past the house again, which we've seen the video of the car passing by. He's on the phone again with mom. He's obviously not going and saying to mom, hey, there's the house where I just slaughtered those four kids. But like you said, I'm wondering what's coming out of his mouth.
Rage.
But he seemed to be in such a good mood with the thumbs up. Do you think it's rage, or do you think he's in a really good mood talking about positive things that have nothing to do with the murder?
And when I say rage, I mean, so rage to me is also chaos. I think he was spewing incoherently. Okay. I mean, just think about it. He, again, let's put ourselves, you know, from what we understand of what was going on his time period. So he's got a lot of chaos at work. He's got a lot of chaos in his life. He just did something very chaotic, which didn't go according to his plan. Mm-hmm. And yet he's got a lot of conflicting new emotions he hasn't felt before, because he just did something he's never done before. Mm-hmm. He's also, which was fueled by rage. And so he's up on a lot of adrenaline. Mm-hmm. Adrenaline's coming down, then going back to the house, it's going back up. Just look at all the data points we're getting on him during his time frame. It's all over the place.
Yeah.
And if it looks all over the place to us, it's probably all over the place in his brain. And so what he's probably doing, pure conjecture, obviously, spewing all the shit out of his mouth. And what do you typically do? What does his mother probably have reps at in life?
Calming him down.
Calming down her son.
Yeah.
So she might not have even been hearing the content as much as she was just trying to get him to calm down, be safe, stop driving around if she knew he was driving.
Yeah.
You know, get back home. You know, so again, when you're kind of throwing it into the situation itself without judging it, just trying to understand it, that seems to make sense that his brain was, because otherwise, if he was thinking and mirroring what he had studied from these other serial killers or mass murders, because again, he's not technically a serial killer. He's the only thing that deviated from what he studied in others was the fact that he went back to the crime scene so soon after the crime was committed.
Yeah.
That's one of only three things he did that deviated from what others have done. And so that meant he was non-thinking at that point, my estimation anyway.
Sure. The fact that he calls them right away, and he's the only person that he has contact with, obviously he doesn't have friends. Right. So his main points of contact, his main people he talks to in his life are mom and dad, it turns out. Probably the only people who are willing to take the time to listen to Brian Koberger.
Of course.
Do you think he was trying, and this is a weird thought, but it entered my mind earlier, in some sort of sick way, like in no way do I think his mom or dad are going to look at this and go, good job, Brian. But do you think there was something in Brian's mind that he's trying to make mom and dad proud? Like he succeeded it without saying what he did. But was there an element of, look, I succeeded at this. Look, I did this. Because I get like that. When you're younger, when you're in your 20s, you start, you know, kind of achieving things, and there's moments in your life that are good, and this is not good, but I think in Koberger's mind it was good. You like to talk to the people that care about you, that you care about, and a lot of times that's your parents if you have a healthy relationship there. And the fact that he was so all about talking to them that day, is there a level of being proud about this and getting... adoration from his parents in some way, shape, or form, but not obviously for the crime, because I'm assuming they don't know about the crime, but in some other way, shape, or form, throwing other things out there where he could get that adoration, is it just a desperate attempt at something normal after doing something insanely abnormal?
There's an element in there. I'm going to flip it a little bit on the language, I think. So what I'm thinking is that his mother gave him such unconditional, at least from it looks like, his mother gave him such unconditional acceptance and love and validation that there's no need to impress her because she already thinks he walks on the water.
Mm-hmm.
Potentially, because again, we don't know, from the frequency of contact. So I don't think it was done to try to seek approval or impress his parents in any way, because he did all he did for himself and to be grandiose in other eyes. You know, I go back to the Ramblin idea on this, is that, you know, he wants to be studied. He wants to be notable. He wants to be notorious. Whether they knew exactly who he was or just as this image of someone to someone like Ramblin, who he respected. So I think from the unrealistic hope that I think people have in situations like this, without saying, hey, look what I did, because that's not right, he can't do that, is that because of the amount of bitching, moaning, and complaining he was doing, he's seeking to hear his mother help him rationalize that, oh, well, it would make sense, you know, listen to all this, that these people would deserve to die.
Mm-hmm.
So I think he's hoping to hear someone, the only person that understands and accepts him non-judgmentally, help him rationalize the horrendous things he just did without him having to ask for it.
Yeah.
So he's hoping, I'm like, why keep calling otherwise? Besides venting, people in our lives. We want people to rationalize our behavior for us so we can accept it. So they accept us.
I mean, as much as in cold and callous as Koberger is, it feels like mom and dad are the security blanket in some way, shape, or form to him. And just the familiarity of speaking to them in his chaotic mind, maybe that presents some sort of calm or peace.
It is. It's routine. Routine makes us safe. Yep. You know, especially, you know, my wife's a teacher and they just went back to school, and some of the things that, and your daughter too just went back. Yep. And at every age, but especially at a younger age, or especially if our minds are not developing as fast as the people around us, and I think Koberger is part of this, is that one of the things that helps us feel safe is routine.
Mm-hmm.
And if part of that routine is a call home, it's why he kept doing it in jail. I've watched a lot of these videos of people that are former prisoners, you know, former inmates, you know, the things that make people and inmates feel safe in jail is the daily routine. You start screwing with their routine, man, and people go bonkers on you.
Yeah.
Because routine helps us feel safe. And so I think part of his routine was not just the unconditional validation he's getting from his mother, but the routine of talking to his mother. I mean, my kids do it with me too. I mean, the routine of texting, you know, my kids of when and how, and, you know, it allows us both to feel safe and comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
Now, and so I think that's part of what he was looking for.
The verbiage that Koberger used when talking about his parents is rather interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Mother, father. Very, very formal. Some may say Norman Batesy. That's what I got out of it right away. But that's how they were labeled in his phone: mother, father, and then a text to his dad. Why? And I'm just paraphrasing. I don't have the exact text in front of me, but it's something to the effect of: father, why is mother not answering the phone? There's a lot to unpack. I mean, me and my daughter joke like that, like, I'll pick her up from school like, hello, daughter. Hello, father. How was your day? But it's in jest.
Very Wednesday Addams.
Yes, we're making fun of it's satire of anyone who would talk like that. But this is real. This is how he communicates. This is how he refers to them. Your thoughts on that, oh, behavioral genius.
Empty shell. When you're an empty shell without emotion and without empathy, you resolve to label the labels and meanings that are descriptive.
Yeah.
That's it. Remember, there's when thinking of Koberger, so many times people are really overthinking this guy. He is so completely empty.
Yeah.
That's why I was talking about this the other day. I think it's probably with you. So all we do is talk about this guy. You know, he is so devoid of absolutely everything.
Mm-hmm.
that there's nothing there but what society puts into it, or what he's chosen for society to, that he takes from it. And so a label of mother and father, well, that's the label. That's what they are. They're mother and father. So I'm going to call them mother and father, unless I'm trying to mimic and mirror something else that's more appropriate in the situation. Because we've seen and heard from other people, at times he can be very charming. Well, that was a script he rehearsed in that time period. Mm-hmm. If you catch him off guard in a situation that he doesn't have a script for, that he hasn't studied someone for, he has no idea what to do. This is why he sucked so bad at destroying four lives, because he couldn't think.
Yeah, went off
script.
He was
mimicking. Yeah. He's mimicking in a stovepipe like this.
What we've just heard from Robin Drake is a disturbing look at a very human connection. One that in most families would be a point of love and stability, but here seems to double as a pressure valve for chaos. Those calls to his mother on the day of the murders weren't just about killing time. They may have been about maintaining routine, about keeping that one unshakable relationship alive so he could feel tethered to something normal after doing something profoundly abnormal. They may have also been about fishing for validation, feeding her complaints and self-pity until she unknowingly gave him the emotional absolution that he wanted. And then there's the whole mother and father language on its own. Sure, some people are just formal. But paired with everything else we know, it feels clinical, detached. Like he's labeling furniture rather than referring to people who raised him. Robin framed it perfectly. Someone so devoid of identity and self-awareness that he simply applies the label that fits the role without the intimacy or warmth that usually comes with it. This part of the story also focuses us, or forces us rather, to think about what wasn't said on those calls. He wasn't confessing. He wasn't panicking about being caught. In Robin's view, he was likely spinning grievances about school, justifying perceived slights, unloading rage without naming its true source. His mother, out of love or habit, may have been trying to calm him, reassure him, smooth over his chaos, just as she probably had many times before. That's the chilling part. The possibility that his emotional state in those calls wasn't wildly different from other days. If you're used to hearing your son in a heightened, agitated state, how do you pick out the day when that agitation comes from mass murder instead of bad grades or a fight with a professor? It's the kind of detail that won't make or break a legal case, but it speaks volumes to anyone trying to understand what drives a killer like Koberger. The calls to mother weren't an afterthought. They were part of his post-crime behavior, just as telling. In their own way, as wiping down a car or bagging up trash. They show us who he turns to, how he manages his emotions, and perhaps how he keeps his self-image intact. Coming up in our conversation, we're going to move to the emotional anchors, to obsessive research. It's Christmas Day. And while his family celebrates, Brian Koberger is diving deep into the histories of more than 20 serial killers. On Christmas Day, was he looking for, and why? We're going to dive into that with Robin Drake. Press subscribe so you don't miss that part of the conversation. And let us know your thoughts so far in the comment section on YouTube. If you're not there already, search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi and press subscribe and comment. Do the same thing wherever you get podcasts. Press subscribe and search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Until next time, I am Tony Bruschi, and we'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Labor Day sale and get 35% off paints and stains August 22nd through September 4th. With prices starting at $31.84, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.